Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Summers are hot. It's a fact of life. But here's another fact. Summers are getting hotter. Heat waves are getting longer, and in some places, the heat has become life-threatening. Climate change is to blame. Here in Charlotte this summer, we've already experienced several days of temperatures at or approaching 100, with heat indices as high as 108, and summer is just beginning. We're not alone. It's happening all over the country, indeed all over the world, so we're going to look at how we prepare for rising temperatures and more frequent heat waves and what Mecklenburg County is doing to help people deal with the heat and hear from someone helping municipalities be better prepared for hotter days ahead. Dr. Catherine Idzorek is with us. She's an assistant professor of geography and community planning at UNC Charlotte. Robert Graham is division chief and deputy director with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Emergency Management Office. And Lisa Sorg is the North Carolina reporter for Inside Climate News. She also spent 8 years as an investigative reporter for NC Policy Watch, covering the environment and climate change and more. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, you have to speak. It's radio. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
There we go. Lisa, I'm going to start with you. Climate change is no longer deniable. It's happening worldwide. It's happening here. We're watching, we're witnessing, we're feeling the effects of it. But there are still politicians working against any policies or funding for things that might work to mitigate or slow climate change in a little bit here in our region and around the globe. At one point here in our state, I believe I'm accurate in saying that the legislature prohibited discussions of climate change, at least along the coastline. Has that changed here in North Carolina?
Well, I think on the ground, there are people, you know, in eastern North Carolina who've lived through record hurricanes, record heat. We have a terrible drought right now in North Carolina. So the people on the ground know it's true. There still are politicians who doubted, and I would add that gubernatorial candidate Mark Robinson is one of those people who has called climate change junk science. So there are still people out there, some hangers-on, but I think primarily in the legislature you're seeing that people have woken up and realized that it's real.
And Lisa, how would you rank North Carolina in relation to other states, either in this region or around the country, in terms of enacting policies or providing incentives or initiatives that would allow or possibly slow or possibly reverse the trend of climate change? Are we doing anything? How do we stand up?
I would say fair to Midland. For example, we have Duke Energy has their carbon plan, which is up for discussion and hearings at the North Carolina Utilities Commission, and they are suggesting or proposing a major build out of natural gas infrastructure. And that's throughout North Carolina, including down by Charlotte, where a separate pipeline, the Transco pipeline, plans to expand. So we have this major build out of natural gas infrastructure, and that is a huge source of methane, which is an even more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So while we do have incentives, we have, you know, solar incentives and whatnot, I think that right now we are taking a step back because we are trading carbon for methane, and it's not an either or, it's both.
Catherine, does this need to be a world, at least a nationwide, if not a worldwide effort? In other words, if we're doing great in North Carolina, if we're doing all the right things, but South Carolina and Tennessee and Virginia are not, is it going to make any difference that we do the right thing, or does it have to be a coordinated effort?
I mean, absolutely. It has to be a coordinated effort across the board at all levels. We've seen an increase in federal initiatives as well as state. And I know that Chief Graham can talk a bit more about the county and then in cities as well. And in addition to climate change, as you mentioned, Mike, we also need to deal with what we call the urban heat island effect in our cities. And that's where we have characteristics of the built environment and urban systems that make hot cities much hotter than the rural areas surrounding. We have the buildings, roads, and paved surfaces of the built environment that absorb the sun's heat and release it back into the atmosphere over time. So really just heating up our cities over the daytime and even through the nighttime. And so in addition to what we need to worry about in terms of climate change and our cities in particular, we need to be able to mitigate this urban heat island effect to create more equitable health outcomes for folks. And this is across the board, all cities across the U.S., even places that characteristically haven't had issues with extreme heat in the past are now starting to feel those impacts.
And Robert, we're going to talk a lot about what Mecklenburg County is doing to help folks who live here deal with the heat this summer. But before we get to that, do you talk? We're probably the most populated and most densely populated and the biggest urban area in this region. But are you talking with people, your counterparts in Gastonia and Catawba and Iredell and other counties around us, even into York County, South Carolina, about heat and what they're doing and what you're doing? Are you working together, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. And thank you for having me. I think this is my fifth time on here with you. We talked about a lot of things, and one of them was nuclear, and you know where I stand on nuclear energy. I want to say this because I think this is a very important thing to start with. For emergency managers, number one, emergency management should always be at the table, whether you're doing comprehensive planning or long-term planning. We are there. We handle a lot of the preventive stuff, the hazard mitigation. Number two, and this is, and I think this gets lost in the ether, climate change is always there. And it doesn't matter when you're talking to people about climate change, they immediately jump to the politics of it. Climate change is always occurring. And in emergency management, we accept that wholeheartedly. So we have to look at the climate and what it is doing and how it's changing and how are we going to react to it. As far as talking to other counties, as you know, we have the McGuire Nuclear Task Force and the Catawba Nuclear Task Force, which really hit a lot of counties. And then our Urban Area Security Initiative for regional planning. And then the state has their own regional planners. So we are always together. We're always communicating. We're always talking about what we're going to do. If we're going to do something like, let's say we're opening shelters, that includes discussions with our neighboring counties, York, Gaston, Catawba, Cabarrus, all the different counties that surround us. So yeah, we're always communicating, always talking about it. But emergency managers are really huge environmentalists. And we are because we're trying to mitigate the impacts on the communities that we serve. And for us in Charlotte, it's 930,000. I've been listening to you since I came on the fire department in 1996. And when I came here, the city of Charlotte's 460,000. So obviously this is a boom town and we have to react to that.
Lisa, politicians or some politicians have been denying climate change and forbidding discussion of it and taking steps to reverse some of the things that have already been taken toward improving things that might improve things for climate change. But it's becoming more difficult to do that, it would seem, because now when you have these stronger, more present storms, when you have longer droughts, when you have daytime flooding along the coastlines in places, when you have the threat of sea level rise, when you have houses falling into the ocean in certain places in North Carolina, when you have rising homeowner insurance rates because of this, not just here, but across the country, it becomes and the need to rebuild infrastructure, which costs a heck of a lot of money, it becomes difficult to put your head in the sand. And if you put your head in the sand, you're likely to drown because of rising sea levels. So are we seeing a change in attitude here? Can it be denied any longer?
Not reasonably. And I think the legislature is better about that. So I think those that do deny it are outliers. There are a lot fewer of them. Their voices are they're not platformed, so to speak. But the fact that there are still some people who deny it, who could someday be in power, is troubling. For example, there is a little known committee the council, the Energy Policy Council, which meets, it's a state appointed board, and they are advisory only, but they discuss really important energy policy. Mark Robinson, as Lieutenant Governor, he presides over that council. There have been 12 meetings, and he has missed all but three. And so it tells me that one of the few outliers about climate change there is, is not even at the energy policy.
Well, how do you explain that? Is it simply based on a lack of willingness to believe scientists? Is it based strictly on not wanting to spend money? Is it because this is an idea being pushed by the libs? How do you explain it?
I think it's a doubt in science or anti-government or don't tell me what's going on. I think it's almost an attitudinal or ideological stance, but that isn't going to matter because Inside Climate News just reported that we have now, as the global average temperatures are now, have surpassed 1.5 degrees Celsius, 12 consecutive months. So we have already tipped over the tipping point. So regardless of what they say, climate change is not listening to our politicians. We have to listen to climate change.
So that's what this program is about. It's about the heat today. And Catherine, I believe that July 4th, which is just last week, was the hottest Independence Day in Charlotte ever. It was 101 degrees. July 5th was also the warmest day on record here for that date. And we are in the midst of a nationwide heat wave that is, it's remarkable how warm these temperatures are getting everywhere, including the upper Midwest, where it's usually, 60, 70 degrees and not very humid in places. Both you and Robert are in the business of planning, but let me start with you. How does what we have experienced here in Charlotte so far this summer or in this area compare with the historical record and with what's going on in other parts of the country?
Yeah, so absolutely. We have seen increased, Charlotte is no exception to the increase in hot days. Over the past 30 years, of course, we've seen heat being the extreme heat being the number one weather-related killer across the country, and is often known as the silent killer because we don't see the impacts of that in the same way that we see hurricanes or tornadoes or earthquakes or things like that. In North Carolina, we see about 4,000 emergency room visits for heat-related illnesses each year during our extreme heat season, and it's going to get worse. We're seeing rising annual temperatures and heat waves that are hotter and more frequent, and those are going to increase with climate change and then also with those effects of the urban heat island, but as we have more development, we lose vegetation and things like that. So the 2020 North Carolina Climate Science Report indicated that most areas of our state are going to see 2 to 3 weeks of very hot days 95 degrees or hotter between 2021 and 2040. So that's something we need to be planning for. Certainly other areas across the country are experiencing heat in their own way. It really varies according to location and context. But I, as someone who grew up in the Midwest and is seeing these extreme, I grew up in northern Minnesota, is seeing these extreme heat, these extreme temperatures there. And then also I moved to Charlotte from Seattle in the summer of 2021 when they experienced the heat dome in the Pacific Northwest. And those communities were not prepared for that heat wave. And I really saw firsthand the impact that that has on urban systems and communities. And that's really what has spurred me to get into urban heat resilience research. And I'm now leading a team of volunteers this weekend to map urban heat here in Charlotte.
We're going to talk about that too, because I think you're still looking for volunteers. We will talk about that, I promise you. Robert, we've been watching climate change unfold before our very eyes. We're experiencing it in real time, steadily warming temperatures, not just in the summer, but in the winter. It doesn't snow very much here anymore. We have more droughts. We have longer, wetter storms when it does precipitate. How do you plan for this? How has Mecklenburg County been planning for what has already happened and for what's to come? And wait a minute, I'm not paying attention to the clock. I hear the music. That means you cannot answer the question because we don't have time. So I'll keep that in abeyance. You can think about it during the break and come back and answer it. Robert Graham is Charlotte Mecklenburg's Emergency Planning Officer, the Division Chief and Operating Director of that. Dr. Catherine Idzorek is with us from UNC Charlotte and Lisa Zorg from from Inside Climate News. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Catherine Adzorik, Assistant Professor of Geography and Community Planning at UNC Charlotte. Lisa Zorg is a North Carolina reporter for Inside Climate News, and Robert Graham is Division Chief and Deputy Director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Emergency Planning Office. Let me repeat that question to you, Robert, because we're watching the heat unfold in real time here, and we're talking about the impact of these triple-digit days and triple-digit heat indices days here in this region. How has the county been planning for what has already happened and what is to come?
Right. So, as you know, the 2040 plan, I know Catherine's going to talk about the 2040 plan. Charlotte is a very treed city, which we love. It's so green, but we have to build on that, right? So the more we can put vegetation we put out there, permeable asphalt, considering how much concrete that we're putting in the ground, really doing anything we can to mitigate those heat islands that Catherine talked about. Interestingly enough, Pineville, which is a small city, also probably because of all the asphalt and concrete, is actually getting hotter and is hotter than Center City Charlotte. Correct. So those are things that we look at. For us, the planning aspect of it includes in Mecklenburg County, a lot of people don't know this, but Charlotte-Mecklenburg Emergency Management is part of the city of Charlotte, but I'm responsible to the county and all six towns. So we work closely with our county, we work closely with the city. Just yesterday, we were in Dina DiOrio's office, our wonderful county manager, meeting with Deputy County Manager Derek Ramos and his team to talk about our response for heat emergencies and where we stood, because those responses are flexible. And so we get information from our National Weather Service at Greenville-Spartanburg, but also our local meteorologists. I just saw a tweet from my good friend Brad Panovich talking about we're entering into the hottest 11 days that we'll see in Charlotte, you know, historically. And Brad is an emergency management nerd. If you don't ever follow him, please do, because he keeps up with all these things, and we talk on a regular basis. For us, it's really about activating our county cooling plan, and we do that in conjunction with talking with the county manager's office. But we also, you know, if we're going to have sustained days where the heat index is going to be above 103 for 4 days, we'll have those discussions. And then we make sure that all the normal services that we have available to us, whether they're libraries or park and rec facilities or other facilities are available for folks to cool down. And we work with CATS to ensure that people can get on a bus and cool down during that period of time.
Doctor, I would think it would be much easier to plan for what's to come as these temperatures continue to rise here and around the world if you were starting from scratch, if you walked into an empty field about the size of Charlotte and said, okay, let's build from the ground up. You could build from the ground up in a way that could ameliorate some of these heat problems. But we live, most of America is already built. It's very difficult to retrofit. So practically, What's the quickest, easiest, most valuable thing that can be done?
That clean slate is really an ideal. I think, you know, practically, nature-based solutions are really a leading edge right now, building out green infrastructure. And as Robert said, you know, increasing tree canopy. We do have a lot of trees here in Charlotte. They're amazing. They provide incredible benefits, but we need more. And there are certainly areas in our urban environment, and I'm thinking of the areas that are in our Crescent, our underinvested communities, the corridors of opportunity areas that the city is targeted for economic development and community infrastructure and programming. Medellin in Colombia has this really amazing green corridors initiative that started in 2016, and it developed these green corridors due to concerns about air pollution and rising heat. And they've cut their average annual temperature by 2 degrees Celsius. And they've done this by implementing a system of more than 30 green corridors that connects tree-lined roadways and parks and vertical gardens and streams. And this provides greater value because of all the external benefits we see from nature-based solutions. So, you know, we're going to see increased physical and mental health. We're going to see increased air and water quality, reduced heat, more sustainable jobs, and it costs less in the long run. Singapore has a very no. similar initiative, but when I think about Charlotte in the future, implementing something like this would go a really long way.
Well, Charlotte's tree canopy has come up several times in this conversation. I was going to bring it up later, but you've already brought it up. Both you and Robert have brought this up, and yet our tree canopy is diminishing on a daily basis. We used to be a city, we used to brag about being the city of trees. In fact, the tree was in the city's logo and in the Cats logo as well. That's all disappeared. And I don't know whether it's coincidence or whether it was because of they're facing reality here. But you are someone who has worked on the Charlotte 2040 plan. And as somebody who studies communities and how they deal with heat, you know that because of the significant loss of trees, that is not making things better. It is making things worse. And some of those trees are falling to development. Others are simply aging out. They're dying and have to be removed and replaced by new, much smaller trees. So how do we reverse this trend? How do we preserve what tree canopy we have left? And what would the impact of success in that effort be?
Yeah, so just a slight correction. So I work at UNC Charlotte. I didn't work on the 2040 comprehensive plan, but I have studied it in depth with my colleague, okay. Michelle Suniga, looking specifically at land use and transportation decisions and then transportation barriers in those corridors of opportunity. And so the piece of the policy that we've really focused on and that I think is key to reducing heat impacts and thinking about designing heat resilient cities is kind of the leading policy in the 10 major policy initiatives in the plan, which is the 10-minute neighborhood policy. And this policy lays out a vision stating that by the year 2040, Charlotte residents would all have access to all of the resources that they need on a daily basis, services, amenities, and such within a comfortable, tree-shaded 10-minute walk, bike, or transit ride from their homes. Now, this is an ambitious vision, and it's not explicitly about heat in the language of the policy, but there are all the elements there that we need. We have the integration of transit and land use. We have support for sustainable transportation modes. And then that really critical piece of the comfortable tree-shaded walk. So thinking about heat health, thinking about the spaces that folks move around in the city to get to where they need to go, our streets, our roadways, our bus system, we need to be able to protect those pedestrians, and trees are really a great way to do that.
Lisa, we can't know what the future holds, unquestionably. There's always going to be some ifs, and some things are not going to turn out to be what we thought they were going to be, but we've been talking about planning for the future here and what the future will be like. What do we think? What do scientists think the future will be like?
Well, we're going to have sea level rise on the coast. In fact, there's a draft sea level rise plan that's out right now that talks about the risks in Duck, in particular, Beaufort, Wilmington. And so that's the water part. Stronger storms. We just saw Hurricane Beryl come through the Gulf. And scientists are predicting a very active Atlantic hurricane season, so we could have more hurricanes. And we think of the coast a lot in that, but you know, we've had terrible inland storms from hurricanes. You know, Tropical Storm Fred in the mountains, you know, devastated areas there. And just recently they had floods in Marion and West Jefferson. So it doesn't take just a hurricane to completely devastate a community. And then we have the heat and the drought. And one of the things that I think scientists are looking at is how are we going to manage our water, for example? How are we going to protect farm workers or people who, there are people down the street putting a roof on a house right now. How do we protect them? Only a third, I believe, of North Carolina's prisons are air conditioned. So scientists are looking at, you know, these major changes in climate and then, you know, in a very micro level. And then it's up to people to be able to plan for that. And it's going to require money because air conditioning prisons is really important, not just for the people who live there, but the people who work there. You know, if you go work at a prison and you don't have air conditioning, it's going to be hard to hold on to folks. So scientists are, I don't want to be a doomer, but it's very serious. Let me put it that way. And it's not, we can't just think about the U.S. It's globally.
Robert, you just mentioned WCNC TV meteorologist Brad Panovich, who does follow this incredibly closely. He's probably one of the most go-getter meteorologists in the world. When you think about how much of his personal life he devotes to this, and he mentioned that we're about to enter the next 11 days, which are probably the hottest period predicted to be the hottest period in Charlotte in this summer, although it may be warmer in August and September than we think. I saw a news report the other day about the current heat wave in Las Vegas, where temperatures were above 110 degrees Fahrenheit and approaching 120, but that was the air temperature. When you touched the pavement was closer to 160 or 180 degrees, as were pieces of metal along the sidewalk, like railings and things like that, which can give anybody who touches them with bare skin bad, bad burns. The pavement would be bad enough to require surgery to replace skin that has been burned. Have there been any serious medical emergencies with the heat so far in Mecklenburg this season?
Always. So July is the busiest time for the Charlotte Fire Department. And Mike, I do want you to know that there's still a tree in the Charlotte Fire Department's logo. So we're still there. but I do want to point this out. Number one, Vegas shouldn't be there. Vegas should not exist. Houston, Texas should probably not be there. New Orleans should probably not be there. The populations go to the coast. And what Catherine was saying, well, we're going to start with blank slate. We wouldn't be where we are, but we have to deal with the realities of what we're looking at. Now, they always say Vegas is a dry heat, right? So when you walk out of your house in the morning in Charlotte and it's humid, you feel that humidity, wear it like a sweater, right? Now, I do want to say this because I was thinking about this yesterday and Catherine kind of alluded to it. During COVID, when we did the stay-at-home stuff, orders, and everybody was at home, I remember wanting to see studies of what that extended period of time with no cars on the road did for our environment. And I haven't seen those yet. I haven't been able to get in touch with those. As an emergency manager, one of my best pieces of intelligence in the morning, I listen to business news because business will tell you a lot of where we're going and what we're looking at. There is an initiative right now for businesses to bring everybody back for 5 days a week. My question, even looking at it from a small perspective, like if businesses were to have their folks work from home 1 day a week, what would be the impact on our environment? And could we measure that over time? So there's a lot of small things we can do. If you go, you know, you go to the grocery store, you go to the drugstore and you buy something and it's got 10 pieces of packaging before you get to your Flonase, that drives me up a wall. All the small things that we can do for our environment that can reduce the heat, we need to be doing. And some of the simple things we need to look at. Lisa talked about the Duke Energy and what they're trying to do. Duke Energy is trying to respond to the increase in batteries that we're using for green technology and AI at the same time. And so there's a lot of discussion that needs to be had in that venue on how we can do the things that are going to lead us in the right direction that can get us to achieve what we're trying to achieve. I love talking about this. In emergency management, we have to deal with consequences. And there's a portion of it that we can do to mitigate it, but we have to plan for what human beings are doing. Yeah. And human beings don't always make the best decisions, unfortunately.
You mentioned, Catherine, that you're about to embark on this heat mapping project in Charlotte. We're one of 14 U.S. communities and 4 international cities participating in this. Exactly what is heat mapping? When did this idea happen and why is it important?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. So heat mapping is a series of, it's a campaign we're launching. We're going to be mapping 100 square miles of Charlotte using mobile sensors. And so these are specially designed sensors that will pick up temperature and humidity data every couple of seconds along pre-planned mobile routes. And so this campaign has been in the works since last August. I've been leading a team called the Charlotte Heat Mappers, which is based in UNC Charlotte's Department of Earth, Environmental, and Geographical Sciences, that also comprises 30 plus partners from around the city, which are community organizations. And we have folks like the Emergency Management Office involved and folks at the state level as well. So it's really a broad coalition. And in applying for this heat mapping grant, we did a lot of outreach, and all of these folks are really hungry for this data. So what we're going to be gathering, and it's happening this Sunday, July 14th, on a very hot weekend, on a day when the heat index is going to be something like 103 or even higher. So we'll be collecting this data, and it's going to give us really a very fine-grained snapshot of the variation in Charlotte's urban heat island across different communities.
I wanted to ask you about that, because we know that urban cores are generally hotter than the surrounding suburbs because of all the concrete and steel and the lack of trees and all of that bouncing up into the atmosphere from the pavement. We already know that. So what does a heat map tell you that you don't already know?
Right. So we know that that urban heat island effect is there, right? We can feel it in our urban areas, but there's a lot of variation even within that urban heat island. So in some cities, we see neighborhoods that are 20 degrees different in terms of temperature because of how much vegetation they have, because of the pavements and hard surfaces. And of course, the hotter areas tend to be communities of color, lower income communities that have been subjected to racist policies in the past. And so we know there are disparities, and this will really help us to understand where those are and to plan targeted interventions.
Is this the first time that we've been involved in this?
Yeah, this is the first time Charlotte's been involved. Raleigh-Durham did the same campaign back in 2021. I know Lisa was involved in that as well. Asheville did it last year. I think the report is not quite out yet, but this will be, we're one of 80 cities now that have done this heat mapping effort over the past 7 years or so.
So from those previous studies, give me some examples of the outcomes. What has happened as a result of discovering on an almost microscopic level what the temperature and humidity is from block to block? What has come from that?
Yeah, so a number of different initiatives. I know Raleigh-Durham has been looking at implementing smart surfaces, so cooler pavements. We've seen Atlanta has developed a community coalition focused on continued mapping of underinvested communities. We've seen other initiatives like targeted tree planting, you know, lots of things we could think about doing here in Charlotte.
Lisa, you've mentioned drought several times in this conversation so far, and it's climate change isn't just about the heat. It's about incredible amounts of water coming in rainstorms. It's about drought. It anecdotally, it seems to me that it has rained a lot in Charlotte this summer. That may be wrong because the U.S. Drought Monitor says otherwise. According to them, Mecklenburg County is abnormally dry, along with many counties to our west. But as you go north and east, they are experiencing moderate to severe drought. I know you cover agriculture, but in 30 seconds, what's the combination of higher temperatures and drought doing to those farmers?
Well, it's the water that is in the soil evaporates, and so they don't have enough water to grow their crops. The corn is curled, and it's a bad situation.
So let's come back to that after the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about hot summers and climate change, making them hotter and making the winters hotter as well. Dr. Catherine Idzorek is with us from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. She's assistant professor of geography and community planning. Robert Graham is here, division chief and deputy director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Emergency Planning Office. We're about to engage in a long conversation about that in a moment. And Lisa Sorg is here. She's a North Carolina reporter for Inside Climate News. We were talking about the impact of hotter summers, climate change on agriculture, on farmers. You just mentioned that it's the drought that they're experiencing, particularly in the eastern part of the state, is having a dramatic effect on crops. Farming has always been a difficult business to be in, because you can't, you're at the mercy of the weather, something that you can't really control or predict. But a good deal of this state's economy depends on agriculture. It seems to me that would drive a lot of these folks in the legislature to want to do something about this. Is it doing anything?
Not that I can see. I think that, you know, right now I was just looking at the drought monitor and the effects on agriculture. For example, there are many counties that are in the severe drought. I think there are 10 as of last week. And a lot of these in our eastern counties where, you know, the breadbasket of North Carolina, even if the hay doesn't grow, you can't feed your animals. So it's a livestock issue. Livestock gets stressed by the heat just like people. So these agricultural impacts are very severe. I was driving through eastern North Carolina not too long ago, and the corn is curling. You know, crops are drying up. It really is a severe economic hardship for those farmers. So, you know, what are we going to do about that? Do we have enough groundwater? Do we have water planning? I mean, this is really in the weeds kind of stuff, but it is what our policymakers have to pay attention to.
I think it was last year that I heard that Georgia peach farmers are considering the reality that they're not going to be able to grow peaches in that state. And it isn't just because of the drought. It's because it doesn't get cold enough in the winter in Georgia anymore, in many places, for the buds to set, which allow the peaches to grow. But you just can't up and move a farm to another part of the country. What are farmers telling you about that situation in North Carolina? Are they facing something similar? Some of the, whatever the crops they're growing, they're realizing we maybe can't do this anymore.
Right. Well, in the mountains, it's a very similar situation where there aren't enough chill hours. That's what they're called, to keep, you know, for the buds to set. A lot of folks are now looking at other types of crops that, you know, you may have grown in Georgia at one time, but now you're going to grow in North Carolina. So the hardiness zones is what the USDA calls them. And the growing season is changing. So that means the crops will change. And that is, you know, one way of mitigating that problem. But I remember just even a few years ago, there was someone in Chatham County who had actually grown a banana. It was a small banana, but they grew a banana. So while we think, oh, great, I would love to have a banana tree, that is an indicator of just how serious this is.
Yeah. It's bad for the crops because it causes them to shrivel and die. It's also bad for people, Catherine. The Environmental Protection Agency has been keeping track of heat as a cause of death both in the summertime and year-round, and has tracked a steady rise in heat-related deaths over the last several years. They're tracking it nationwide. Most of us have the safety net of air conditioning, but not everyone does. Who is most affected? Who is most at risk from these higher temperatures that are stressful for humans and in some cases not survivable?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, those heat health impacts are certainly not distributed equitably. So there are many groups that are more vulnerable, children and older adults, for one, folks with pre-existing health conditions, folks with disabilities, lower income folks. We see a very, very strong link between health and heat and income, for example. And then folks who spend more time outside. So we have, of course, houseless individuals, outdoor workers, emergency responders, athletes, and then even folks who are walking around our cities and waiting at bus stops. You know, and these tend to be the groups that are more invisible to policymakers and that are disproportionately people of color in our communities.
Yeah. Robert, this is an international problem, but is it local municipalities like ours, Mecklenburg, City of Charlotte, the surrounding towns, is this where the rubber meets the road in not only planning for climate change and hotter days and wetter days and drier days, but also just dealing with the reality of it on a day-to-day basis? Is this where the rubber meets the road?
Yeah. So, and just for the good of the group, Charlotte Mecklenburg Emergency Management Office is within the Charlotte Fire Department. So that's why I'm a division chief for the Charlotte Fire Department. And as a firefighter, and I always will be a firefighter, it is miserable when we're working the summer. And I'm just going to tell you, it's just how it is. And it's very difficult on our first responders, to go out into the heat and then come back and try to cool down. And over a period of time, we see a lot of heat-related illnesses from going to fires or being out on wrecks or hazmat scenes or whatever, not only in the fire department, but Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, medic at EMS. And so part of emergency management, we source resources. So we just entered into an agreement to buy a new rehabilitation truck for our emergency responders that are on extended incidents for large amounts of time. But go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, I saw an interview with one of those firefighters fighting the forest fires out west, and they were asked how they deal with the heat and what it's like. And they say, well, imagine when it's 110 degrees outside, imagine putting on a sweater and a sport coat, a heavy wool sport coat, and an outer coat and a scarf. That's what we're doing. That's what the equipment that to protect us feels like. Is that the same for local firefighters?
It is. It's about 80 pounds of gear. And so those men and women that get in that turnout gear underneath, they are soaked in sweat. And so our health and safety division within the Charlotte Fire Department, which is absolutely awesome, they spend a lot of their time and effort making sure that our firefighters are properly hydrated and that they go through a rehabilitation before they're allowed to enter back into the fires. You know, back when I came on, that wasn't the case. And you learn pretty quickly, you better take care of yourself, because if you don't take care of yourself, then you really are creating problems for your other firefighters. But the same thing goes for all responders.
In terms of individuals affected by this heat, citizens that you serve, mm-hmm. Affected by this heat, what has the county been doing to help those most impacted?
So probably the largest population that we worry about are the homeless population. And so we spend a lot of time and energy working with our homeless shelters to make sure that they can bring in extra amounts of folks that seek shelter, but also getting our information out through social media. We work a lot with apartment complexes and then senior housing whenever they have issues. But we always encourage our property owners and management to have a plan, whether that's extra air conditioners or window units that they can put into a community room if their power goes out. Because what we see a lot of times, that we have severe weather come through Charlotte, we have power outages, and then inevitably we get a phone call, hey, we have folks that are, you know, post a storm, it's incredibly humid, they don't have air conditioning. And so we do an education with the property management after we help solve their issues for the next time, that hopefully they're better prepared. The county gives out free fans, but we already talked about some of the things that the county will stand up, including all the county facilities with extended hours, having CATS buses where folks can get on and cool down. But we really, it's a lot of the educational piece, you know, don't be out in the sun, go find shade and find a place to hunker down, but make sure you're hydrated during the period of time.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but part of the problem here is that houses in the 19th century were built because they didn't have air conditioning. They were built in a way that the hot air flowed to the tops of very tall ceilinged rooms, and there was a flow of air through the bottom with windows and doors. Most modern houses aren't built that way anymore. So if you don't have air conditioning, you're in a stifling box. I know that Mecklenburg County has been setting up cooling stations. Have you also been doing what are called spray grounds, where you're spraying water on people? Is that mostly for kids, or can adults be sprayed down as well?
No, actually, there are five spray grounds in Mecklenburg County. You get those from the website, but they're open from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily, and anybody can go down there. I'll do that. When I go to Savannah, they have one. If it's really hot, that's what we'll do. I'm from Henderson County, and so I grew up without air conditioning. We had attic fans, and you know, you could sleep great when you had an attic fan going. And there are still folks I run into in Charlotte, including one in my office, that grew up here in Charlotte without air conditioning. And so that is you know, if you look at Charlotte and why Charlotte is Charlotte, you could argue it's the interstate system, you could argue it's the airport, you could argue it's internal combustion engine, you could argue it's the right to work state. I argue it's because of air conditioning. So when air conditioning came into being, all of a sudden the population of Charlotte, it blew up. And a lot of southern cities are in the same boat. If you go to Dallas on a hot day and you look at Dallas, you're like, why would you want to live here? air conditioning.
Yeah. And of course, if you stand next to an air conditioner, it's blowing hot air outside. I don't know
That's
whether
right.
that impacts the climate or not, but it certainly would seem to. Lisa, the organization Climate Central looked at heat island index values in 44 U.S. cities last year. Those are the areas where the average temperature is at least 8 degrees above the surrounding area. And they found that Charlotte and Raleigh are not the places to be. In Charlotte, they found that about 9,000 people feel at least 9 degrees hotter than the baseline temperature in both uptown Charlotte and in an area south of Belmont in Gaston County, which you would think would be immune to this. But there were other areas around the city that were just slightly cooler than the heat island by a half a degree. How concerned are officials, should officials be, about this?
Well, they should be very concerned because that's a disparity in, you know, the quality of life or even the fact that you can live in those situations. As Catherine was saying, I was part of the Durham-Raleigh mapping initiative in 2021. And one thing that was interesting in Raleigh is that there is a downtown park called Nash Square. It's very leafy. It's not a very big park, but it's where everybody goes when it's hot. Just outside that park on the sidewalk was something like 8 degrees hotter. You could literally walk across the street, and that's what the difference was. So if you think about, you know, a mall with that hot surface, the pavement radiating up against you, or, you know, even at night, those buildings radiate the heat. That's what you're seeing.
What has President Biden's administration been doing to help this nationally in terms of slowing climate change, and how successful have those efforts proven to be so far?
Well, it's been a huge part of the Biden administration platform in terms of grants and putting money through the IRA or the bipartisan infrastructure law. There's a lot of money flowing into these initiatives. I think it's probably premature to say how successful all of them are because sometimes it takes time to build stuff. But I think the fact that there is that kind of it shows a moral priority, frankly, toward combating climate change. And we need that not only on a federal level, but we need it on a state and local level.
For whatever reasons, Republicans in general have been recalcitrant when it comes to this. I don't know exactly why. Donald Trump, of course, pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accord when he was in office. The New York Times reports that Trump has said he would reverse regulations on coal burning for electricity. He has said he would unwind all of the pollution limits on automobiles that encourage the development, the sale, and the proliferation of electric vehicles. He has said he would gut the Inflation Reduction Act, which you just referred to, which President Biden signed into law in 2022, and which is commonly considered the nation's largest investment in fighting climate change, with more than $370 billion in tax credits over 10 years to help us shift to cleaner forms of energy. He has said he would unleash domestic energy production, quote, like never before, and drill, baby, drill. And Trump has outlined policies that the Times says would add 4 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere. How would the impact of doing some, most, or all of these changes affect what we're going through now, what we anticipate going through in the future? How quickly would the average person recognize whatever change may occur?
It would be devastating. I mean, we're already experiencing it. Climate change is not in the future. It is right now happening. It would accelerate. And if you have children or grandchildren or love someone who has children or grandchildren, they are going to be suffering. And I don't use that word lightly. They're going to be suffering while we're, you know, in another aspect of the universe. They are going to be here living with those consequences of those decisions. And it just, it depresses me to think that all that progress, however incremental it might be, would be completely unraveled. It's absolutely, frankly, unconscionable.
When you hear meteorologists and radio announcers say the temperature, it's usually the temperature at the airport. So if it's 90, if it's going to be a high of 96 today, they're anticipating that's the temperature at the airport. It could be hotter or warm or cooler where you are. But for people who work outside, whether it's 93, 96, or 103, that is critical. Robert, any tips for people who work outside? Because some of them have to work outside. And I only have 30 seconds.
Yeah, wear the proper clothing. Make sure you're keeping up with weather forecast. Understand when the humidity impacts you. Stay hydrated and take breaks. Take frequent breaks. Those are all good things that will help you through the day.
And we don't know what the weather holds for the rest of the summer, but if the precursor of July has been any indication, it's going to be hot. Thank you for the conversation. I appreciate it. I think we need to keep talking about this so people can understand how this really does affect them now and going forward. Dr. Catherine Idzorek is Assistant Professor of Geography and Community Planning at UNC Charlotte. Robert Graham is the Division Chief and Deputy Director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Emergency Planning Office. And Lisa Sorg is a North Carolina reporter for Inside Climate News. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.